Then they brought the ambulance up to this sunken road. Well, he was the man that bound me up, the conscientious objector. But he was chatting away. He got a lovely bedside manner in the circumstances. He was chatting away, I suppose, to calm me down, chatting away, and he told me he was the conscientious objector. I thought he was a great fellow. And he really must have been a conscientious objector, because he's right there in the middle. He wasn't dodging the action in any way or form. He's right there in the middle with me and all the others, right in the middle of it. He wasn't dodging anything. He must have been really a conscientious objector. I'd take my hat off to him. It's take a lot of moral courage to stand out and be a conscientious objector in a country at war. You know you're going to be misunderstood, misrepresented, don't you? Mm.
That was a British private in the First World War called Eric Nunn, talking about how he felt about being treated by a conscientious objector. And this week in the podcast with me, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, we want to look at the story of one particular conscientious objector, but a man that was so close to the action, he lost his life. He was no coward. He didn't deserve a white feather. His religious beliefs prevented him from killing another man, but he still wanted to contribute to the war effort, and he did, at the cost of his life, leaving his young wife a widow. That man's name is Lance Corporal Alfred Adams, who was serving with the 2nd 7th Battalion of the Manchester Regiment. He was 33 years old when he died of his wounds on Friday the 26th of April 1918. And it's his story that we're going to talk about this week, as we follow his story from a working class area of Northampton to the horrors of Passchendaele, to the shock of the German spring offensive in March 1918, to a prisoner of war camp, to a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery in the German city of Cologne. Come with us on a journey with Lance Corporal Alfred Adams. But before we look at his individual story, what was a conscientious objector in the First World War? Well, before the Great War, there'd never been compulsory military service in the United Kingdom. But as the number of volunteers dried up as we reached the end of 1915, in 1916, January of 1916, the first military service bill passed into British law. And from March of 1916, military service was going to be compulsory for all single men in England, Scotland and Wales that were aged between 18 and 41, except those that were involved in jobs that were essential to the war effort, or were perhaps the sole support for dependents or medically unfit, or those who could show that they had a conscientious objection. And this was therefore to give an opportunity to 16,000 British men to go on record as conscientious objectors. And it's only a small percentage, really, of the almost 6 million men that served in the Great War in different roles. And it did, as you can imagine, create a vast range of public opinion on these conscientious objectors, from their friends, from their family, and most importantly, from the men that had signed up. And there were lots of different reasons why men would want to be conscientious objectors. Most common one, and the reason that Alfred Adams didn't want to fight, was a religious reason. In the Bible, it says, "Thou shalt not kill," and men like Alfred took that at its word. There were also political reasons why some men might not want to fight. And in this short clip of an interview, a conscientious objector called Walter Griffin explains to the Imperial War Museum where he felt you cannot overcome evil with more evil.
The very things which you try to accomplish by the use of force, you bring on to yourself, because you must have something worse or more powerful, which is evil, in order to come the evil which you are trying to overcome. The result is that after a period, you have got not only the very thing which you are trying to oppose, but you've got something worse than the one that you're trying to oppose. You cannot overcome evil with evil.
For most of us who are interested in the Great War, the views of that man, Walter Griffin, we won't be able to understand. But we're looking back in history, therefore, it's important to listen to views that we don't necessarily agree with or appreciate or understand. We need, if we can, to try and get inside the minds of these men and the conflicts of emotions and thoughts and opinions that they must have been struggling with, trying to determine what was the right thing to do. So who was Lance Corporal Alfred Adams? Well, he lived in the St James's area of Northampton, a working class area then, and it still is. He was a congregational lay preacher, and it led on to him being a conscientious objector. But when people started sending him and his wife, White Feathers, he decided to join up before he was conscripted. He initially joined his local regiment, the Northamptonshires, and shortly before he went out to France, he was transferred to the 2nd, 7th Manchesters, and they travelled to France on the 30th of May 1917, and that's just a few weeks before the beginning of the Third Battle of Ypres, the Battle of Passchendaele. The 2nd, 7th Manchesters were part of the 66th Division, the East Lancashires, and they suffered terribly during that Battle of Passchendaele. In last week's episode, we talked about Alfred Adams and the 2nd, 7th Manchesters, this territorial unit, and we talked about their experience in the latter stages of the Battle of Passchendaele and what happened to them at Christmas. And now we're winding the clock forward, and it's March of 1918. What they don't know is that the Germans are about to unleash their massive spring offensive against the British across about 50 miles of front line in the Somme area. And Alfred Adams and his comrades are in the eye of that enormous storm. And as with episode one, we're going to look at what happened as much as we can through the eyes of Corporal Alfred Adams in the letters that he wrote home to his wife, Alice. And they're going to be read by his maternal grandson, Jeff Allen. And we're going to follow the story right to a conclusion. And we'll see how this particular conscientious objector was indeed no coward.
Yeah.
So this is the day before the battle. He doesn't know it.
Yeah.
But there's this enormous German force the other side of no man's land.
Right, okay. My dear wife, just a few lines to let you know that I am all right and quite well, and I hope you are, as I hope you are at present. We have had rain this last 2 days again, and the weather is quite changed. I hope you are still having good weather, and I know you are always better when it is warmer. I am sending a few shoots of black currants, which I want putting in the garden. Soak them in water for about a couple of hours and put them in very firmly, about a third in below the soil. Anywhere will do in the garden, as they can be moved when they are grown. I know it is rather late for them, but if they grow, they will be interesting when I get home again. Excuse more, as I'm in hurry to catch post. With much love, your loving husband, Alf. And copious kisses again.
The Germans' spring offensive on the 21st of March 1918, the battalion diary of the 2nd, 7th Manchesters is very short. It says that on the 20th of March, it was a quiet day today. On the 21st of March at 10 past 4 a.m., violent enemy bombardment. 5:25 a.m., verbal instructions to take action. Marched out at 6:10 a.m. to Bross Wood and held position. 6:30 p.m., remainder of battalion consisting chiefly of B Company, fell back on redoubt on flanks of Jeancourt Valley. That's all there is. There's no more information. At the end of the month, another officer with different handwriting has written that the 66th Division withdrew from the line and moved back to the Amiens area. Total casualties from the 21st of March, 37 killed, wounded in action 214, and missing 321. So that's nearly 600 men. In amongst those 321 missing men was Alfred Adams. I found in the records a card that was completed by his German captors, and it tells us that he was serving in D Company of the Manchesters, and in brackets it says acting as stretcher bearer, missing on the 21st of March 1918, and the request via the Red Cross for information about him has come from his sister, Mrs. Claridge. And there's another handwritten card in the records that's dated the 5th of June 1918. And handwritten on there, it tells us that Alfred was taken to Limburg prisoner of war camp, and that's where he died of his wounds over a month after being wounded and captured. Now, on this podcast, we like to look at what happened from both sides of the wire, and I've got here an account that was written by a German soldier that was directly opposite the 2nd and 7th of the Manchesters that day. The German spring offensive covered a vast front, at least 50 miles, and approximately in the middle of the ground that the Germans attacked was where the 2nd and 7th Manchesters and Alfred was located, north of St. Quentin and east of Peronne. So this is what that German soldier wrote about the opening of the German attack in this area on the 21st of March. He says, "One more day and we go off, 21st of March. Even more artillery and infantry are taking over the designated positions. The second wave mans the rear areas, while the Sturmtruppen are already deployed along the front line. If only the English don't notice, but even so, it would be too late. Our nerves are strained to the outmost. The weather is getting better. Since last night, S3s has become calm again, and there is more space available for the moment. Near the village perimeter, an area has been marked out for a huge military hospital to be erected tonight, with a temporary POW camp just beside. In the afternoon, we were given information that our division will remain in reserve of the Second Army. We are not pleased at all, as this order means carrying provisions and digging to keep the roads towards the front running. But someone has to do this unbeloved work if we want the battle to become a victory. I sense that we have to get across the crater zone first to succeed at last. I look at the map given to me by my company CO, and it shows a puzzling maze of English trenches, 20 kilometres deep between here and Peronne. And it is only there that the Somme Desert begins after all. Nowhere along the Western Front are there more natural and artificial obstacles to overcome." Lieutenant Kruger said this, "Slowly the clock hands are moving on. Midnight, everything is completely calm. Not a single word is betraying the gigantic gathering of many 100,000 warriors and the clustering of thousands of gun and minenwerfer. A starlight sky is shining above the attackers sitting tight. Again, all watches are synchronised. 3 a.m. Our hearts are pounding. Expectations are high and can't be read in hard-featured faces. 4:30 a.m. and everybody is leaving their shelters to witness a spectacle unheard of in history. 4:40 a.m. we're holding our breath. Almighty God in heaven, send us victory. Suddenly the earth is trembling and shaking, even more than thunder and lightning. No, it is a sea of flames and a rolling thunder that fills the air. Unbelievable in its hideousness and indescribably beautiful at the same time. A whooshing and hissing in the sky, which itself is clear and full of stars. We are shivering under the concussion. The mighty storm lasts steadily until 9:40 a.m. 5 hours of death and doom poured into the enemy. euphoria replaces the tenseness. In the beginning, Tommy is answering vividly by firing stray shells of various calibre into no man's land. Between 7 and 8 a.m., his artillery fire begins to fade away and finally ceases completely, but his machine guns are firing, probing, looking for targets not yet visible. The Englishman is brave. One has got to hand it to him, resisting even this incredible thunderstorm and holding fast. About 1 hour after the opening of our guns, the clear sky was exchanged for a curtain of dense mist and fog. Artillery observation is not possible, so firing depends exclusively on maps and calculations. The treacherous weather will leave enemy machine gun nests undamaged, a fact that will cost us dear. The fog is getting denser and is filled with irritants, which causes breathing difficulties and coughing. Is this our gas or the enemy's? Now it's our turn to get ready to jump off. At 9:10 a.m, the attacking companies leave their trenches, hoping to reach their prearranged destination. But the fog is so impenetrable that one can barely see the nearest man, never mind the target 1,200 metres ahead. Nevertheless, all platoons are gathering at their exact jump-off positions at the gaps in the wire entanglement. Nobody is missing. Everybody is eager to attack. Some men have unscrewed the filters from their gas mask and put them directly into the mouths for easier breathing, a funny sight. Instead of deploying the respective groups of Sturmtroopers to fulfil their given task independently on their own, we have to stick together far too long. I order, stay in a row and grab the coattail of the man in front of you and begin to lead this peculiar column through the wire with the help of a compass. One can't see anything and all sound is muffled. Is this machine gun a German or an English one? And where does it come from? It is getting uncomfortable. We do not charge at all. We are stumbling forward. 9:40 a.m. Attack time. But where is the English trench? Where is the bloody fallen tree? Our artillery can't see the infantry and keeps moving on the rolling barrage, thus enlarging the gap between us and the fire curtain. What is left of the enemy will be able to take a stand, and so he does. Finally, we approach a wire entanglement. Everything is quiet. Suddenly, two machine gun open up, one just ahead and another a few yards to our left. The projectiles are whistling along the flanks of our column, but nobody gets hurt. We get even closer, but still we can't see anything. We just can hear the tack, tack, tack of the machine gun. The enemy can't see us either, but he might be listening. We are fanning out and head for the enemy trench in haste to avoid the bullets. Again, most machine guns are firing close by, but miss until two men get hit by grazing shots, and one of them receives a bullet on the steel helmet, bouncing off its side. We have to hit the ground and make the two machine guns our next target. Otherwise, no further advance is possible. A loud rattle behind us alerts us. The artillery has done its job and the scene becomes totally calm. Volunteers of all companies creep forward through the lingering fog to locate English machine gun nests. The machine gun to our left must have been silenced or removed, but the other one up front still rattles. Stam, carrying a light machine gun, gets the order to silence the adversary. Stam slowly advances alone to locate the exact enemy position, when suddenly some Englishmen appear out of the fog. Stam shoots first, but is caught by the now alert machine gun and receives a fatal headshot in return. We are furious and seek revenge, but the English machine gun keeps us at bay. Out of the fog, 12 Company emerges and takes part in beating the enemy machine gun down. Fight ends with the company CO suffering a shattered foot and the valiant English crew killed by hand grenades. We hold on as far as the first line must be just ahead, and we don't know what is going on. Suddenly, several Englishmen appear out of the fog, startling me at first, our first prisoners. So we have to advance further. When the English take note of me and the pistol in my hand, their faces appeared scared to death. One of them approaches, whining, showing me a picture of a humble wife and three children, while the others stand around watching my face for a reaction. I give them a reassuring wave and point with my pistol towards the advanced dressing station. That changes their mood and the bunch moves on quickly with a relieved smile. In the English shelters, many dead and wounded are lying near the entrances. Their comrades are standing paralysed nearby with rifles in their hand. No shot is heard. Everybody stands under the devastating impact of the hand grenade, drum fire. My men are standing around the numbed enemy, wondering why these men don't offer resistance to avert certain captivity or worse. Only my sharp command, take their rifles and break them, disrupts this strange situation. And so my men pry the English rifles out of the bearer's hands, smashing and breaking the rifle butts against the road pavement. The unwounded English are frisked for revolvers and hand grenades as we expect a counterattack every moment and do not want our prisoners to become part of it. Still, the dense fog swirls around this grisly sight and prevents any view further down the road, where according to our map should be more dugouts and probably enemy. Consequently, the English soldiers are able to walk and they must leave the scene at once. We call on the enemy to get out of the dugouts and gather. In the end, about 50 or 60 unwounded men climb over their dead or wounded comrades. Too much for my small platoon to lead them back. Grenadier Kronkowski will lead the bunch to the rear, with the support of slightly wounded Grenadier Wetton and two more men. The Englishmen climb the steep slope in an amazing hurry and soon disappear into the still impenetrable fog. Now, I wonder whether Alfred Adams was one of those men captured by that platoon, wounded, maybe carried back himself by other stretcher bearers. And the other thing I noted right at the beginning of that passage is that the German attackers are believing in God. They're calling on God for help in their advance to victory, fighting against Alfred Adams, who's also believing in the same God, but on a different side of the wire. We can also look at the experience of the men from the 2nd, 7th Manchesters. I've got a couple of accounts here from a man called Ralph Frost. And he said this: "It was then that I was buried twice by shells exploding behind and blowing the earth over me. I was released with help, and I can remember hearing someone say, 'Poor old Frosty has got that one.' But no, I was all in one piece. I'd had another lucky escape. We were in single file, and the chap in front of me was almost cut in half, and the one behind me beheaded. They would only be about a yard from me. Strange as it may seem, I did not feel afraid. Shortly after, our officer, Lieutenant Beasley, was badly wounded. We still carried on to the front line. By this time, the fog had thinned a bit. I should think we marched about 3 miles. When out of the mist, 5 men of the 2nd 5th Manchesters were seen coming along towards us, shouting, 'Don't shoot, we're British. Jerry's taken our front line, and we are the only survivors.'" Now, as we know, they were ordered to march up to the front line and try and stem the German attack. And all day, the 2nd, 7th Manchesters fought the Germans. And they had, to a certain extent, managed to pin down the attackers. But their machine gunners were being attacked from the air, and also by these mass formations of the Germans. But finally, the order was given to retire. But in the chaos, that order didn't reach most of the men, and they couldn't escape. They made no attempt to escape, and they surrendered at 5 o'clock. And Ralph Frost, again, we hear from him, he was one of those men who held on all day. He said this: "I must have led a charmed life, for a bullet went through the left sleeve of my tunic on a level with my heart without so much as scratching me. Round about 5 p.m, we retreated about 100 yards to a small quarry. But the end was near, for all our bombs had gone and we were down to about 15 rounds between us. Second Lieutenant Fox, a corporal and 15 men were all that remained of our company. Fox was wounded. It wasn't long before Fritz surrounded us. I'll never know why he did not wipe us out. Our corporal wanted us to fight it out, but we told him in no uncertain terms that he would be shot unless he surrendered. My first thought when Jerry came right in was he will shoot us or use the bayonet, and then I said, I shouldn't get that parcel from home, as I'd received a letter to say there was a parcel on the way. There was only 16 men and one wounded officer left of A Company. I grabbed my water bottle, which was full of rum, which I'd been saving in case I was cut off at any time. Unlike Alfred, Ralph Frost did survive until the armistice, and he returned home in March of 1919, 12 months after he was captured. I've found this other account. It was written by another wounded soldier, Lance Corporal Denton. He was in hospital in a place called Pendlebury. This was his memory from that awful day. Well, he says, soon after the gas had cleared enough to take off gas masks, we moved forward towards the sunken road. While doing so, we had further casualties. Corporal Matthews being severely wounded and several men killed. And Corporal Matthews, I hear, had died the next day. However, we reached our position, which was, when we got there, being shelled heavily, but a good cover was obtained in the road. And soon after, platoon number 2 was ordered to take up another position, which I should think about 500 yards in front of our company's position. We reached our trench, which was near the wood, which was being shelled by our artillery, the position becoming quieter about noon, but about 1 o'clock, Fritz was sniping from the wood, and then we saw some of his machine gunners getting in position, but were soon victims of our rifle fire. He became more active as the afternoon wore on. His aircraft did us a little damage with machine guns and bombs. About 4 o'clock, his artillery blew our trench in many places, but we still hung on. Soon after, he was sweeping our trench with machine gun fire from the rear, and we discovered some people on our left had withdrawn and allowed him to get behind us. However, Lieutenant Prime resolved to hang out to the last. It was about 6 o'clock when Fritz made a determined attack, attacking from back, front and rear. Our lads, however, did well and hung a good many of them on the wire, which caused him to retire a little and take position in a trench about 25 yards from us. But thanks to a box of Mills grenades, we gave him a nasty time. Well, it was about 6:45 or a little later when masses of them came out of the wood and from our rear. We did our best to hold him up, but Lieutenant Prime, seeing it was impossible to hang on any longer, gave the order to retire down the trench to the right. It was here that many of our platoon were taken prisoners. I was in the rear of the party and we were firing as we went down the trench when Lieutenant Prime came by me and walked up the trench towards Fritz, which was at that time about 20 yards away, and by what I saw, he was taken prisoner. Another party of Fritz came upon us, and a German NCO addressed us in English, asking us to surrender. We did not take the idea, so we used a little more 303s and were once again free. But our number was small then, and about 12 of us were taken prisoner and taken to the wood. Although I did not see Prime after he went up the trench, but I think it's very probable he was taken prisoner. So the only thing I noticed there compared to the other accounts is the timings, really. He's talking about them surrendering around about 7 o'clock, whereas I think one of the previous accounts talked about 5 o'clock. But there's semantics, really. We get an idea of the terror that they must have gone through as they were suffering so many casualties and then finally given no choice, no option, really, but to put their hands up. And in his account there, he talked about an officer, Lieutenant Prime, who was he? Well, I found out he was Arnold Prime, and he was initially reported missing in action. But some months later, a newspaper in Manchester confirmed that he was never seen again and presumed killed. He has no known grave, and like so many others, is remembered on the Poitiers Memorial. I've got a photograph of him here and the newspaper obituary, which I'm about to read to you. And I'll put a copy of that on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. It's a very brief article. It says he came from 47 Shore Road, Heaton Moor, which is near Stockport, now in the county of Cheshire. Posted missing since the 21st of March, is now officially presumed to have been killed on that date or since. He joined the Artist Rifles in January of 1917, receiving his commission 8 months later, and proceeded to France in November of last year. Lieutenant Prime was on the staff of the city treasurer and did some valuable work in the organising of the Soldiers and Sailors Families Subcommittee, with which he was connected in the capacity of cashier and accountant for 2.5 years. His brother, Lance Corporal R.F. Prime, who came over with a 2nd Canadian contingent, died of wounds some time ago. Next week, I'm going to be on the Somme and hopefully going to be recording some audio for future podcasts. And we're going to be in the Poisier area following the Australians once again. So I'm going to visit the Poisier Cemetery and the memorial wall that surrounds it. I think there's 14,000 names of missing soldiers from the 1918 battles. And I'm going to find the panel that remembers the Manchesters that died on that day. And in particular, I'm going to find the entry that relates to Arnold Prime. I'm going to print off a photograph of him and I'm going to place that there and spare a few thoughts for that brave man. No one knows what happened to him. He just disappeared along that trench and was never seen again. When we look at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records, casualty records for that day, we find that it was eventually established that 96 men of Alfred's battalion died on that day. And with their positions being overrun, it will come as no surprise to find that 86 of them have no known grave and they're remembered on the Poisier Memorial to the Missing. Back home in Northampton, all that Alice and Alfred's parents know that he's missing. And there's a notice placed in the newspaper that says that Lance Corporal Alfred Adams was for 2.5 years in the employment of Messrs. Mark & Co. Printers in the Drapery, and for a number of years, a local preacher at the Doddridge Church is missing. That's all it said, that's all they knew at that stage. And then, after news had come through of his death, some more notices were placed in the paper. The first one says, "In loving memory of Lance Corporal Alfred Adams, the dearly loved brother of Mr. and Mrs. Claridge of Doddridge Street, who died of wounds in Germany. It says, we longed for his safe returning. We longed to clasp his hand. But God has postponed the meeting till we meet in a better land." From Nellie and Harold. And the second one says, "In loving memory of Lance Corporal Alfred Adams, a loving son, a brother kind, a beautiful memory left behind. He bravely answered duty's call. His life he gave for one and all, from his loving mother, sisters and brother." So now we're going to return to my chat with Alfred's grandson, Jeff Allen. We're going to discuss what happened next and see how the story for Alfred concluded.
I mean, this is it. When you put your hands up in any war, in any army, you don't know what the enemy's going to do.
No.
So we now know what it was like to be in that situation. Oh. So he's been captured and he's wounded as well, isn't he? We know he's got a bullet in the leg.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have known at this stage what was going to happen to him.
Yeah.
You know, was he going to die of his wounds? You know, was he going to be left behind? Were the Germans going to kill him? But that's not what happened. The Germans looked after him.
Yeah.
You know, they captured him and he was taken back to Germany where they operated on him.
Mm.
And then, you know, they did everything that they could, as we did with the Germans that we captured.
Yeah.
I mean, there were POWs that were killed, but usually at the point of capture.
Right.
You know, someone's just lost their brother or their best mate's just been killed and they're not in the mood for taking prisoners.
Right.
That did happen in all wars.
Yeah.
It's happening now. You know, in Ukraine and Russia, I'm sure. But on this occasion, you know, there's so many of them, 13,000 they've taken prisoner, that the Germans have looked after them. So the next letter is the third. What date's that one?
It's 13th of April.
That's the one. So he's now in captivity. He's in a German POW camp at Limburg, which is about 50 miles northwest of Frankfurt.
"Now, as regards myself, dear, I'm going on as well as can be expected. But they told me yesterday it was a bad wound, and so I can't expect to be able to get about again for some time. I went under the X-rays last night, so I expect the next thing will be an operation to take the bullet out. I'm hoping and praying that it may be very successful and that it will not lead to any serious complications. You will be glad to know that I'm in a good bed and well looked after and I'm not in much pain. only for about an hour after my wound is dressed each time. As you know, I never was a big eater, and almost every meal some of my food is left and sent back, especially dinner times, when they bring a plate piled up with vegetables and meat, and also a dish of soup. I have the soup and then eat what I can of the other. So you see, dear, I get plenty of food, in fact, more than I can eat. I expect you will think it rather hard, this happening to me like this, but I consider myself fortunate to be as I am. I know a lot myself who went under. God alone knows what happened to the others. I'm afraid that there would not be many left all right. Well, dear, cheerio. The war is ended as far as I'm concerned. We now await the day of peace so that we may be united to each other again. I hope that you and darling Eva are quite all right and doing the best you can. You would laugh if you would see me now. I've not had a shave since about March the 20th, so you can imagine what I look like. I'm thinking of putting them in curlers or plaiting them. Give my love to dear mother and all at home, also Sis and Harold and Rose when you see them.
So he's been wounded, but he's got what they soldiers call a blighty wound, you know, a wound that's going to get you home.
Okay.
But he can't come home, he's in a POW camp.
Yeah.
What they did, both sides, they exchanged prisoners that were badly wounded through Switzerland, through the Red Cross, and maybe that was going to be an option. But he was being well fed and well looked after by the Germans at this stage. And his last letter is on the 21st of April. This is his last, he doesn't know it, this is his last letter. This is post-operation then, isn't it?
Okay. My dear wife, the time has come when I can write to you once more, and I do so with great pleasure. You will be glad to know that I went through my operation on the 15th, and I think I'm going on all right since. Of course, it will be some time yet before I shall be able to get up, but as long as things go well, I must have patience and not grumble. I understand it takes several weeks to get a letter from England, so do not expect a letter from you yet. I hope that this will find you and darling Eva quite well. With loving affection, yours, Alf.
And that is his final letter.
That's his final letter
on that day.
Do we know what he died of?
Well, he's obviously died because of the complications of the operation.
Yeah.
The most likely thing that's happened is what they call gas gangrene. Okay. It doesn't mean to say gas has got in there. It just is disease.
Okay.
So many soldiers died of this.
Yeah.
It's so unfortunate because he was receiving the best possible care.
Yeah.
But still, we don't know for certain because there's no record there. But it probably is, you know, he's got an infection.
Yeah.
When he's wearing his uniform, you know, made of cloth.
Yeah.
And when that bullet or shrapnel has gone into his leg,
he's
taken dirt with it. And a piece of his dirty uniform into the body.
Yeah.
That was on the 21st of March. He's not been operated on for three or four weeks later.
Yeah.
And it could be that disease, that infection was growing within inside the leg without them even knowing.
When we're talking about 1917
as well. That's right. You know, they've got blood transfusions at this stage. Yeah. They're being introduced. But once, you know, it needed to be operated on and cleaned out as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Very unfortunate. I looked in the archives and it said that Alice died in September 1935 at the age of 49. She was 49 when she died. But just in conclusion then, what are your own thoughts about it, having now read the letters and known the story? How do you feel about it, his legacy?
Well, he was a God-fearing man all his life, wasn't he?
And you didn't ever obviously get to know him or Alice, but it obviously means a lot to you now, doesn't it, even now, all these years later.
Yeah.
As you can hear from Jeff's voice, he was finding it very difficult, very emotional to think about the granddad that he didn't know. But of course, Eva was the only child of Alice and Alfred. And she grew up and she got married. And along came Jeff. And Jeff's had his own family, and therefore the legacy of Alfred Adams is that he lives on through his own descendants. Between August of 1914 and the armistice in November 1918, the German forces captured almost 300,000 Commonwealth servicemen on the Western Front. Most were transported to camps located throughout Germany, like the one that Alfred was in near Frankfurt. And really, Germany was poorly equipped to look after these men and clothe them and feed them. But under the international agreements, the Geneva Convention, they did have certain rights, the prisoners of war, and both sides, British and the Germans, did as best they could to adhere to these agreements, and the Red Cross also monitored conditions in the camps. And I think we touched on it during the interviews a couple of times during this period during the war, the British and German governments agreed to exchange prisoners who were too badly wounded to fight again, and hundreds of prisoners of war were repatriated through the Netherlands. Now, of these 300,000 men, as many as 12,000 Commonwealth servicemen died in captivity. Some of the men, like Alfred, were badly wounded when taken prisoner and died of their wounds after arriving in Germany. A few were died as a result of violence perpetrated by their captors. Some non-commissioned officers and privates were forced to work and died of exhaustion or accidents while labouring in places like coal mines or quarries or steelworks. But especially during that 1918 period, the main cause of death in German prisoner of war camps was disease, with the flu pandemic being the main cause. There were, at the end of the war, numerous cemeteries scattered around Germany where these 12,000 men had been buried. And there was more than 1,000 of them at the end of the war were buried in the what's now known as the Cologne Southern Cemetery in that beautiful city on the Rhine River. And the British forces, the Commonwealth forces, entered Cologne on the 6th of December 1918, less than a month after the armistice, and was occupied under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, until January of 1926. And during this period, the cemetery was used by the occupying garrison. And in 1922, it was decided that the graves of Commonwealth servicemen who died all over Germany should be brought together in four permanent cemeteries, so concentrated, a bit like what they did on the Western Front. Those four cemeteries are in Kassel, Berlin, Hamburg, and here in Cologne. And over the course of the following year, graves were transferred to Cologne Southern Cemetery from 180 burial grounds in places like Hanover, Hessen, the Rhine, and Westphalia. There's now almost 2,500 First World War servicemen buried or commemorated at Cologne. The Commonwealth's section of the cemetery contains 132 graves from the Second World War, most of them servicemen who died with the occupying forces. And there are, in addition, 676 non-war graves and 29 burials from other nationalities. And that means that the total number of burials at Cologne is 3,324, of which 2,322 are from the UK. There's 45 Canadians, 34 Australians, 34 New Zealanders, 14 Indians, 14 from South Africa, and one Belgium. And from the Second World War, as I said, there's 125 from the UK and 7 Canadians. I've been a couple of times to the cemetery at Cologne. It's a beautiful place to visit. It's a stunning city, Cologne, very popular with visitors, especially on Rhine cruises. So if you do go there, I think it took us about half an hour to walk from the city centre out to the cemetery. Please do make the effort to go. And if you do go, please take the time to go and visit the grave of Alfred Adams. So thank you very much once again for tuning in to these two special episodes about this brave stretcher bearer, conscientious objector, Lance Corporal Alfred Adams. We remember him and his wife, Alice, and we remember his daughter, Eva. They've all now passed on. We remember all of them by the sounding of the last post.